you're watching The Big Fight with me, Maria Shakil. Does the United Nations still serve a purpose? Is the UN relevant or are its best days behind it? In the world beset by wars, humanitarian crisis, and other global problems, is the United Nations becoming incapable of ensuring multilateral responses? When the UN was founded in 1945 after the Second World War, the objective was it ushers in a defining new era in human history in the quest for peace and progress. Eight decades later, UN is facing an existential crisis by becoming a behemoth which isn't representative and inclusive, away from reforms. Once authoritative intergovernmental organization in the world, has today become completely dispensable as it has refused to reform itself. Over the last few years, India has been consistently seeking permanent membership in the UNSC, but it hasn't been accommodated. Several visiting foreign political dignitaries and international coalitions that have pushed for UNSC reforms have also voiced support for India's candidacy for permanent membership of the Security Council. However, despite persistent lobbying by India, experts are not hopeful of change in the near future. Among the five permanent Security Council members, all except China, that is the US, the United Kingdom, France and Russia, have categorically supported India's candidature in the past. As a close competitor of India in regional and international politics, China is unwilling to endorse New Delhi's position. China is the only Asian country, remember, with a permanent Security Council seat. But how long can this blocking really continue? India today is the fifth largest economy. Recent population trends indicate that India has already overtaken China in terms of total population. With this, India is estimated to have the largest share of the global population at 17.8%, which is equivalent to more than one-sixth of the global population. In terms of the share of working-age population, India is expected to overtake China in 2030. So if a country as strong, resilient, and a strong voice of the global south is not in the UNSC, then the question that we ask, in the absence of reforms, is UN really relevant now? Joining me first on the show is Syed Akbaruddin, who served as India's permanent representative to the UN from January 2016 to April 2020. He's joining me from New Delhi. Ambassador Akbaruddin has been also very vocal about the slow pace of reforms in the UN, and particularly that he spoke in the context of Security Council. Sir, thank you so much for speaking to NDTV. You had likened the reform process to a Greek tragedy, where despite years of discussions, little progress has been made. We are living at a time when there are multiple live conflicts. Is UN inconsequential, irrelevant, and why is it really irrelevant?
So, Mariam, first of all, thank you very much for giving me an opportunity to engage with you and through you to your large audience. Having said that, I acknowledge the fact that the peace and security architecture of the United Nations is not fit for purpose in the 21st century because it represents an archaic architecture of the past, the challenges that we face now, and the countries that can bring solutions to these are different. So I accept that peace and security, there are challenges. But let's not forget that these challenges are not limited to peace and security. There are multiple other challenges in the world relating to climate change, humanitarian affairs, outer space, etc., the health. And we are moving into securitization of many other arenas. Now, if you take it in the whole, the UN has a role to play in those. It doesn't have in conventional warfare like we are seeing right now in West Asia. But then West Asia is being a challenge for everybody. It was there in 1947 when the first time the UN dealt with West Asia. 70 years plus since then, there's been no solution, but nobody else has provided a solution. So it's not fair to say the UN alone is to blame. There are some naughty problems which nobody is able to resolve for reasons whether one side or the other doesn't want to follow it. So I wouldn't put all the blame and say UN is irrelevant, inconsequential, etc. In peace and security, it certainly can do with reform.
Okay. Ambassador Akbaruddin, you know, one of the statements that have been made by you in the past has been also about global governance structures. You have said that the present structure of the UN is unfit to address 21st century challenges. And of course, there is a need for a more representative and inclusive Security Council, the one that reflects the diversity of international community. Why is it that we haven't got a Security Council position till now? You know, you have served for several years there. And why is the resistance continuing from quarters which have been opposing India's, permanent membership for years?
So you're right that there is a resistance to change, and it's not primarily about India. If it was only about India's membership of the Security Council, this matter would have been resolved much earlier, because I don't think there are big challenges of a nature that are insurmountable for India's membership. But when you try and reform an international body, there are other issues. Who represents, for example, Africa? That remains a major challenge. Africa says it wants two countries. It's not yet decided which would be the two countries. There are 54 countries in Africa, each of them having a different view. Similarly, there are challenges about the veto. Whether the veto should be restrained is a big emotive issue for most countries. Having said that, the five veto-wielding powers do not want any change. Also, finally, we are right now in an era where competition dominates, and it's not an era of cooperation. Multilateral organizations and international organizations only work on the basis of possible cooperation. This is very like the Cold War, when there were no resolutions from the Security Council. There was one in 1959, for example. So we've been through worse times. The challenges are mounting today, but it's not about India. So India's case is sui generis. India is the most populous country, the country which is now economically shouldering much more than it was, and it is ready to provide global public goods. So India's case is pretty clear. I think the challenges are about the other elements of a package, and that will still take time.
Okay, then would you say that the United Nations has missed the reforms bus? Is reform still on card, and how long do you think it'll take? Because, you know, in terms of timeline.
So, reform is not an event that you miss it. It's a process. It's got delayed. Been sidetracked for long. The hope always for diplomats is that tomorrow will be better than yesterday. So, we can't give up hope. Aspirations of a country like India, which is a young country, which is looking forward to a lot of hope in the future, we cannot give it up. It will be difficult. It's a challenge, but I would think so. The issues which, if you do not, let me put it another way, if you do not reform the Security Council, people will find other ways to address their problems. So, it is in the interest of the Security Council and its permanent membership to try and accommodate the aspirations of a newer group of states who can add value to the Security Council. So, it is in everybody's interest. It's only when will everybody see that it is in their interest. But we've started a new process under the Summit of the Future. It's a much more time-bound process. So let's have faith in it, give time and space. And it took a lot of time. I mean, all multilateral decisions take lots of time. For us, in the outside world, we are used to instant upgrading of our systems. For example, if you have an iPhone, you just press a button and it upgrades to the next level. Unfortunately, global governance is not like that. It takes time, but we have no cause for feeling despondent, because our future will be better. It will be a future in which we hope India will play a greater role inside the Security Council if reform is possible. Otherwise, there are institutions which lose their way. Multilateral institutions have also lost their way, and nobody would want that to happen. So okay, it's best that they reform, but it's not a time-bound program that will lead to that.
Okay, so Ambassador Akbaruddin, if you're saying that there's no realistic timeline for achieving meaningful reforms, then can there be key milestones that we can watch out for? You know, one view certainly is that there's no need, there is a need, I would say, to reform the veto power of the permanent members. Should it be reformed or abolished?
There's an ideal world and there is a real world. In the ideal world, it should be abolished, but which parliament is going to say that I am ready to give up the veto and abolish it, and I will now reduce my powers in a global body? It's going to be difficult to get support for any of this in any of the five permanent members. So the way forward is incremental change. So what is happening on the veto? There are two countries which haven't vetoed a single resolution for now close to 30 plus years. That's UK and France. There are other measures saying that in case of veto, it should be limited to extreme events, not veto on procedure, not veto on issues where everybody else is on one side. These are extreme, egregious events. You can use the veto. So there can be at best a restraint on it. I do not expect any of these countries to give up the veto, certainly not the US, Russia, and China. They made it very clear they will not give up the theoretical framework of the veto. So while you may want it to be abolished, the best option is some format of restraint.
Yes, you know, on multiple occasions, Ambassador, you've also spoken about little progress being made about the intergovernmental negotiations, you know, which of course began in 2008, that is also stuck in limbo. There is a new global order, and there's a fast-changing global order as well. We are living in times, as you said, which is far more which is about competition than cooperation. Then what really is the use of these bodies or groups? Or do you think G20, for example, is far more inclusive and representative? You know, when India had the chair of G20, we saw it emerge as the voice of the global south. The G20 expanded and became G21.
So you're right that there are newer bodies which have emerged, which are doing a good job in the area that they're looking towards. So the G20 is an excellent body for economic decision making. The G20, as you know, doesn't want to touch political issues. We're talking of the political and the security and peace and security architecture. There is no other body. So also, let's also acknowledge that many of these smaller minilaterals and plurilaterals, these are important, but they don't have legitimacy on by themselves. So what happens when the G20 decides? The G20 members then take it to the World Bank or to the IMF and then get the imprimatur of a legal change there. Similarly, there is no body for peace and security. And so by dispensing with whatever is a half a relic of the past, you then have nothing. You then have to create something. So perhaps it's better to create, but we are not in a position to create at this stage. You will have to make do. Otherwise, sure, there will be other coalitions of the willing coming up. People will work in smaller groups and get things done. But that's all right for big countries like us. What happens to the global south, of whose leadership we lay claim to? They are 110 countries with populations of less than 10 million. They cannot be part of these small groups. And they always say that nothing about us without us. They won't want climate change. They won't want artificial intelligence to be discussed in small groups without even being engaged. So you have to have a platform. And that platform will be an inclusive platform because whatever smaller groups do, they will have to bring it to larger groups to get approval, because climate change cannot be decided by 20 countries and implemented and expect that others will follow. Similarly, artificial intelligence. Similarly, cyber. So there are many areas which are transboundary in nature where you will require the cooperation of broader than small groups. And for that, if the UN is not there, there have to be some other platform that will give a legal imprimatur. Otherwise, what the G4 does or the G20 does, it doesn't have a legal bearing, because they still have to go to a organization or entity which has a legal bearing. And please tell me which will be that international entity which has a legal bearing.
Okay. So let me ask you that question, which is that international entity which will have the legal bearing, and then what really is the future of the United Nations?
So we come back to that we need to have an inclusive organization, however imperfect it is. We live in an imperfect world. So to think that the UN is the only imperfection in a global landscape is not a fair option to look at. Sure, big inclusive bodies will be slow. They will be like the minimum common denominator, but they still are required. So each has a place. Minilateralism, plurilateralism, all have places, but they cannot dispense with multilateralism. So you will have to work out a harmonious situation where all three exist. It will take time. It may take years, may take decades. These things take a long time, because if you have to move far, you have to move with everybody. If you want to move fast, you can move alone. But then transboundary issues cannot be solved alone or by small groups or by self-proclaimed clubs. Let's be very clear. Look at the NSG. I mean, the NSG is a self-proclaimed club which doesn't want India inside it, despite India being a nuclear power, despite India using nuclear energy for a lot of purposes. Does that country, does that grouping contribute to growth of nuclear energy? No, but it's a self-declared club. So self-declared clubs have a role in the sense that they can be used as sounding boards. They can come up with suggestions, but you still have to go to inclusive bodies, and that body, for all its inadequacies, will remain the United Nations. If it didn't exist, you would have to create some other body of that sort.
All right, Ambassador Sayed Akbaruddin, thank you so much for speaking to NDTV, and thank you for sharing your thoughts. I'm going to go straight to Washington, D.C. now, where Ambassador John Bolton is joining us. So remember, he served as 25th United States Ambassador to the United Nations from 2005 to 2006. And was also U.S. National Security Advisor. Ambassador Bolton, thank you for speaking to NDTV. The question, of course, is about the relevance or irrelevance of an institution such as United Nations at a time when we are looking at a full-blown war playing out in the West Asia. And do you think there is a need to relook or revisit these institutions? Is UN then representative or relevant in these times?
Well, I think the political decision-making institutions of the UN are largely irrelevant. I mean, the UN is a vast, complex organization. That's part of its problem. Some of its specialized and technical agencies do good work when they stay out of politics, but the Security Council, the General Assembly, the Human Rights Council are paralyzed and therefore largely irrelevant. And I'm not sure that there's any way to bring meaningful reform. Many people have tried over the years. There are a lot of suggestions. Very hard to see how any of them can be brought to bear.
Okay, so if institution like this, which has almost become ineffective in resolving conflicts, and all the talks of reforms haven't really ensured that it is in sync with the times, then why is it really there, in the sense that what is its engagement with the current times and how does it really impact global governance?
Right. Well, as I say, I think it's important to look at each particular piece of the UN because some pieces are clearly much, much better than others when they do the work they're supposed to do. Some of them are pretty obscure, like the World Intellectual Property Organization deals with a hugely important subject matter. And so far, and we should keep our fingers crossed, so far it's done good work. But the Security Council, for example, I don't think is fixable in its current format, where you have Russia and China in this increasingly close axis, with China's the dominant partner, determined really to pursue their own course. And it's a gridlock. It's not a Cold War exactly, but it's not dissimilar from the gridlock of the Cold War. The reform that I've suggested, based on my very long experience in UN matters, is that we need to change the funding system. And I would eliminate the system of assessed contributions, where every nation pays a percentage of the budget of the different UN bodies, and replace it with entirely voluntary contributions on this radical theory that if something doesn't work, you shouldn't have to pay for it, and you should put your money into institutions that do work. And I think that reform has very little chance of being adopted by the membership either. But that I think, is something that might actually wake the UN up.
Okay. So if the United Nations Security Council has not been expanded, I'm talking about in the context of India. India is already the fifth largest economy, on its way to becoming the third largest. Then in terms of the population, and it is 17.8%, which is more than one-sixth of the global population. You have the endorsement come in from UK, US, France, and also from Russia. Then how long can, and it's a country which is also the growing global, has a global voice and its presence, then should be given a place at the UNSC to make it more relevant.
Sure. Look, the composition of the permanent members of the Security Council was decided in 1945 and was appropriate at the time. It's not 1945 anymore. The trouble is trying to imagine how you make the Council more like the world situation today without simply gridlocking it even further. Japan was the first country that the United Nations considered making a new permanent member. Richard Nixon, back in his administration, said the U.S. was in favor of adding Japan as a permanent member. So that was about 50 years ago. And obviously, Japan has never been made a permanent member because China won't let it happen. And this is the sort of gridlock when it comes to India. Of course, Pakistan then says, well, we should be a permanent member too. In the Western Hemisphere, Brazil says, well, we should be a permanent member. And then Mexico and Argentina say, well, we should be permanent members. I will tell you, as an alumnus of being an ambassador who spent a lot of time on the Security Council, that 15 members is all already a large group of countries. Remember, when the charter was written in 1945, there were 11 members on the Security Council. And I think there's a kind of law of politics that every time you make a decision-making body bigger, you make it less effective. So this is the kind of these are the kinds of considerations that have led to gridlock in multiple proposals put forward in good faith by a lot of people who have studied the matter very seriously. All have resulted over a 50-year period in no change in the membership of the Council.
But Ambassador Bolton, given the role that India is playing at the global stage, don't you think there is a need to view India's case differently in comparison to all those countries that you have just mentioned?
Well, if you can make that argument, of course, but in the UN system itself, these various interests, for example, the most recent American proposal was to have two permanent seats for Africa rotating among different nations and without the right of veto. Which I think the African governments have rejected as being second-class citizens. And I assume if India became a permanent member, it would want a veto as well. So to imagine how to push forward the Indian case, you'd have to convince China not to veto India's membership. And they won't say publicly that they're going to veto it. They'd say, well, but you shouldn't treat India alone. What about Pakistan? What about this? Japan would certainly say, well, we should have a permanent seat too. China would veto them as well. Once you get started on this, the history, it's not my opinion, it's the history of those who have tried to reform. You run very quickly into a circumstance where you're talking about a Security Council of 25 to 30 members, even if you could get approval for it, which I think would make it even more into a debating society than it already is now.
Okay, so when UN was founded in 1945 after the Second World War, of course, the objective was to ensure peace and progress. The times that we are living in is that we are seeing multiple life conflicts. Then what really is the purpose of UN if it is not also a peace builder and failing in its primary role?
Right. Well, you know, there's still a UN peacekeeping force in a long disputed border between India and Pakistan, which I don't think contributes very much to a resolution of that issue. There are lots of UN peacekeeping forces around the world. They've become part of the landscape, in effect. They're not contributing to a solution to the problem. They're now embedded in the problem. So I think what started out with great hopes in 1945 has proven not to be any more workable in terms of political questions than the League of Nations was. And I don't know that anybody has a solution to that. It's produced a huge bureaucracy in New York, which the government of the city of New York is very thankful for because it contributes to the economy, but doesn't contribute to to the principal reason for which it was founded. Again, I want to say that there are these specialized and technical agencies, many headquartered in Geneva, Vienna, Rome, that do good work. And maybe it'd be better to split them off from the United Nations and save them from the politicization that unfortunately characterizes decision-making we see with the General Assembly.
Okay, Ambassador Bolton, do you think the war between Israel and Iran, which has taken this form, unfortunately, can have a potential impact on or can impact the outcome of the elections in the U.S.?
Yes, it could, because I think right now we're waiting to see how Israel responds to being the subject of the largest attack of ballistic missiles in world history on Tuesday, 200 missiles, the largest ballistic missile attack ever. And I think Israel will respond very strongly, hitting significant targets in Iran, and that could cause the conflict to grow more intense. That could have an effect on global oil prices. I think they're up only about 2 or 3% since Tuesday, but they could go up significantly. So again, hard to predict what the impact would be, but could it have an impact on the election results? Yes, absolutely.
All right, Ambassador Bolton, pleasure speaking to you, sir. Thank you so much for your time here on NDTV. We are shifting focus now to this opposition, which is continuing a blocking of India's bid for UNSC from China. In fact, China strategist Andrew K.P. Leung is joining me from Hong Kong. Sir, thank you so much for speaking to NDTV. China, of course, has been persistently blocking India's bid for UNSC seat. Why is China resisting it so vociferously? India has been the voice of the global south. India ensured more inclusivity, particularly including the African nations in G20. Do you think China can be more accommodative on realizing India's aspirations and not being a roadblock here?
I think that the world has been completely upended and has changed since the Second World War, when the United Nations was founded, because a lot of water has passed under the bridge. The United Nations structure is inherited from the outcome of the Second World War. The winning countries, the five main winning countries, maintain their veto-wielding seats in the United Nations. Because after all, I mean, these were the main combatants during the Second World War, which is the largest holdback on the humanity. But then the situation is now is difficult to maintain the world order anymore. Because the first of all, you have the rise of the Global South and the southern countries, developing countries, including India, including the African Union, including the Arab League, including a lot of countries in South Africa and Southern America, and they want their voice to be heard. And not only a voice to be heard, because their voices are heard in the General Assembly, but the General Assembly is a largely a talking shop. It's got no teeth. It's got no vetoing power. And so I think that the United Nations is increasingly becoming ineffective to deal with a different world order.
Yes. So if UN is becoming ineffective, as you say, Andrew Kyopilyong, my question then is about India's bid for permanent seat in the UNSC. Do you think, given the role that India is playing on the global stage at present, India, China should not be really blocking India's bid?
Well, I think that if we talk about the veto-wielding permanent members, yes. It's not just the decision made in the United Nations at this top level, but it's also involved a great deal of global dynamics. So if you look at the permanent members now, you have the United Nations, you have France, you have the United Kingdom. They're both in the Western camp. And they are now increasingly anti-China. And then you have Russia, you have China. And the admission of India, which is, of course, India has been viewing China as an antagonist or as a rival, would upset the dynamics in the Security Council. So I think that it would be, India's voice could be heard. I think that it's even more important. It's not just India, because if India wants to be heard, then even though some countries were defeated in the Second World War, but it's a long, long time ago. I mean, Japan's economy is quite big, and so Japan, well, why can't we my voice be heard? And Germany. So I think it's important to find a way to accommodate the influence of the Global South.